Side 2, Mona Lisa Overdrive, by William Gibson. Continuing on page 47. She found the charger in the third cabinet, beside a bubble card of Durham's. She bent close, peering at the gray plastic, the Japanese logo, afraid to touch it. The charger looked new, unused. She was almost certain that she hadn't bought it, hadn't left it here. She took the drug from her jacket pocket and examined it, turning it over and over, watching the measured doses of violet dust tumble in their sealed compartments. She saw herself place the packet on the white marble ledge, position the charger above it, remove a derm from its bubble and insert it. She saw the red flash of a diode when the charger had drawn off a dose. She saw herself remove the derm, balancing it like a white plastic leech on the tip of her index finger, its moist inner surface glittering with minute beads of DMSO. She turned, took 3 steps to the toilet, and dropped the unopened packet into the bowl. It floated there like a toy raft, the drug still perfectly dry. Perfectly. Her hand shaking, she found a stainless nail file and knelt on the white tile. She had to close her eyes when she held the packet and drove the tip of the file against the seam, twisting. The file clattered on tile as she touched the flush button, and the 2 halves of the empty packet vanished. She rested her forehead against cool enamel, then forced herself to get up, go to the sink, and carefully wash her hands. Because she wanted, now she really knew, she wanted to lick her fingers. Later that day, in a gray afternoon, she found a corrugated plastic shipping canister in the garage, carried it up to the bedroom, and began to pack Bobby's remaining things. There wasn't much, a pair of leather jeans he hadn't liked, some shirts he'd either discarded or forgotten, and in the teak bureau's bottom drawer, a cyberspace deck. It was an Ono Sendai, hardly more than a toy. It lay amid a tangle of black leads, a cheap set of Stimtrodes, a greasy-looking plastic tube of saline paste. She remembered the deck he'd used, the one he'd taken with him, a gray factory custom Hosaka with unmarked keys. It was a cowboy's deck. He'd insisted on traveling with it, even though it caused problems during customs checks. Why, she wondered, had he bought the Ono Sendai? And why had he abandoned it? She was seated on the edge of the bed. She lifted the deck from the drawer and put it on her lap. Her father, long ago in Arizona, had cautioned her against jacking in. "You don't need it," he'd said. And she hadn't, because she'd dreamed cyberspace, as though the neon grid lines of the Matrix waited for her behind her eyelids. There's no there there. They taught that to children, explaining cyberspace. She remembered a smiling tutor's lecture in the Arcology's executive creche, images shifting on a screen, pilots in enormous helmets and clumsy-looking gloves, the neuroelectronically primitive virtual world technology linking them more effectively with their planes, pairs of miniature video terminals pumping them a computer-generated flood of combat data, the vibro-tactile feedback gloves providing a touch world of studs and triggers. As the technology evolved, the helmets shrank, the video terminals atrophied. She leaned forward and picked up the trode set, shook it to free its leads from the tangle. No there, there. She spread the elastic headband and settled the trodes across her temples, one of the world's characteristic human gestures, but one she seldom performed. She tapped the Ono Sendai's battery test stud, green for go. She touched the power stud, and the bedroom vanished behind a colorless wall of sensory static. Her head filled with a torrent of white sound. Her fingers found a random second stud, and she was catapulted through the static wall into cluttered vastness, the notional void of cyberspace, the bright grid of the Matrix ranged around her like an infinite cage. "Angela," the house said, its voice quiet but compelling, "I have a call from Hilton Swift."
"Executive override?"
She was eating baked beans and toast at the kitchen counter. No, it said confidingly. Change your tone, she said, around a mouthful of beans. Something with an edge of anxiety. Mr. Swift is waiting, the house said nervously. Better, she said, carrying bowl and plate to the washer. But I want something closer to genuine hysteria. Will you take the call? The voice was choked with tension. No, she said. But keep your voice that way. I like it. She walked into the living room, counting under her breath. 12, 13. Angela, the house said gently, I have a call from Hilton Swift. On executive override, Swift said. She made a farting sound with her lips. You know I respect your need to be alone, but I worry about you. I'm fine, Hilton. You needn't worry. Bye-bye. You stumbled this morning on the beach. You seemed disoriented. Your nose began to bleed.
I had a nosebleed.
We want you to have another physical.
Great.
You accessed the Matrix today, Angie. We logged you in the Bama industrial sector.
Is that what it was?
Do you want to talk about it?
There isn't anything to talk about. I was just screwing around. You want to know, though. I was packing some crap Bobby left here. You'd have approved, Hilton. I found a deck of his, and I tried it. I punched a key, sat there looking around, jacked out.
I'm sorry, Angie.
For what?
For disturbing you. I'll go now.
Hilton, do you know where Bobby is?
No.
You telling me Net Security hasn't kept tabs on him?
I'm telling you I don't know, Angie. That's the truth.
Could you find out if you wanted to?
Another pause. I don't know. If I could, I'm not sure that I would.
Thanks. Goodbye, Hilton.
Goodbye, Angie. She sat on the deck that night, in the dark, watching the fleas dance against floodlit sand, thinking of Brigitte and her warning, of the drug in the jacket and the derm charger in the medicine cabinet, thinking of cyberspace and the sad confinement she'd felt with the Ono Sendai, so far from the freedom of the Loa. Thinking of the others' dreams, of corridors winding in upon themselves, muted tints of ancient carpet. An old man, a head made of jewels, a taut, pale face with eyes that were mirrors, and a beach in the wind and dark. Not this beach. Not Malibu. And somewhere, in a black California morning, some hour before dawn, amid the corridors, the galleries, the faces of dream, fragments of conversation she half recalled, waking to pale fog against the windows of the master bedroom, she prized something free and dragged it back through the wall of sleep. Rolling over, fumbling through a bedside drawer, finding a Porsche pen, a present from an assistant grip, she inscribed her treasure on the glossy back of an Italian fashion magazine. T-A. Call continuity, she told the house over a third cup of coffee. Hello, Angie, said continuity. That orbital sequence we did 2 years ago, the Belgian's yacht. She sipped her cooling coffee. What was the name of the place he wanted to take me? The one Robin decided was too tacky.
Freeside, the expert system said.
Who's taped there?
Tally Isham recorded 9 sequences in Freeside.
It wasn't too tacky for her?
That was 15 years ago. It was fashionable.
Get me those sequences.
Done.
Bye.
Goodbye, Angie. Continuity was writing a book. Robin Lanier had told her about it. She'd asked what it was about. It wasn't like that, he'd said. It looped back into itself and constantly mutated. Continuity was always writing it. She asked why, but Robin had already lost interest. Because Continuity was an AI, and AIs did things like that. Her call to Continuity cost her a call from Swift.
Angie,
about that physical. Haven't you scheduled it yet? I want to get back to work. I called Continuity this morning. I'm thinking about an orbital sequence. I'm going over some things Tally did. I may get some ideas.
There was a silence. She wanted to laugh. It was difficult to get a silence out of Swift.
You're sure, Angie? That's wonderful. But is it really what you want to do?
I'm all better, Hilton. I'm just fine. I want to work. Vacation's over. Have Porphyry come out here and do my hair before I have to see anyone.
You know, Angie, he said, this makes all of us very happy.
Call Porphyry. Set up the physical.
Ku Poudre. Who, Hilton? Maybe you?
He had the resources, she thought, half an hour later, as she paced the fog-bound deck. Her addiction hadn't threatened the net, hadn't affected her output. There were no physical side effects. If there had been, SenseNet would never have allowed her to begin. The drug's designer, she thought. The designer would know. And never tell her, even if she could reach him, which she doubted she could. Suppose, she thought, her hands on the rust of the railing, that he hadn't been the designer. That the molecule had been designed by someone else, to his own ends.
Your hairdresser, the house said.
She went inside. Porphyry was waiting, swathed in muted jersey, something from the Paris season. His face, as smooth in repose as polished ebony, split into a delighted smirk when he saw her.
Missy, he scolded, you look like homemade shit.
She laughed. Porphyry clucked and tutted, came forward to flick his long fingers at Angie's bangs with mock revulsion.
Missy was a bad girl. Porphyry told you those drugs were nasty.
She looked up at him. He was very tall, and she knew enormously strong. Like a greyhound on steroids, someone had once said. His depilated skull displayed a symmetry unknown to nature.
You okay? He asked, in his other voice. The manic brio shut off as if someone had thrown a switch.
I'm fine.
Did it hurt?
Yeah, it hurt.
You know, he said, touching her chin lightly with a fingertip, nobody could ever see what you got out of that shit. It didn't seem to get you high.
It wasn't supposed to. It was just like being here, being there, only you didn't have to...
feel it as much?
Yes.
He nodded, slowly. Then that was some bad shit.
Fuck it, she said. I'm back.
His smirk returned.
Let's wash your hair.
I washed it yesterday. What in? No, don't tell me. He shooed her toward the stairwell. In the white-tiled bathroom, he massaged something into her scalp.
Have you seen Robin lately?
He sluiced cool water through her hair.
Mr. Lanier is in London, Missy. Mr. Lanier and I aren't currently on speaking terms. Sit up now.
He raised the back of the chair and draped a towel around her neck.
Why not?
She felt herself warming to the net gossip that was Porphyry's other specialty.
Because, the hairdresser said, his tone carefully even as he ran a comb back through her hair, he had some bad things to say about Angela Mitchell while she was off in Jamaica getting her little head straight.
It wasn't what she'd expected.
He did?
Didn't he just, Missy?
He began to cut her hair, using the scissors that were one of his professional trademarks. He refused to use a laser pencil, claimed never to have touched one.
Are you joking, Porphyry?
No.
He wouldn't say those things to me, but Porphyry hears. Porphyry always hears. He left for London the morning after you got here.
And what was it you heard he'd said?
That you're crazy, on shit or off. That you hear voices. That the net psychs know.
Voices. Who told you that?
She tried to turn in the chair. Don't move your head. There. He went back to his work.
I can't say. Trust me.
There were a number of calls after Porphyry left. Her production crew eager to say hello. No more calls this afternoon, she told the house. I'll run the tally sequences upstairs. She found a bottle of Corona at the rear of the fridge and took it to the master bedroom. The stim unit in the teak headboard was equipped with studio-grade trodes that hadn't been there when she'd left for Jamaica. Net technicians periodically upgraded equipment in the house. She had a swig of beer, put the bottle on the bedside table, and lay down with the trodes across her forehead. Okay, she said. Hit me. Into tally flesh, tally breath. How did I ever replace you, she wondered, overcome by the former star's physical being. Do I give people this same pleasure? Tally Angie, looking out across a vine-hung chasm that was also a boulevard, glancing up to the inverse horizon, squares of distant tennis courts, Freeside's sun, an axial thread of brilliance overhead. Fast forward, she told the house. Into smooth pumping muscle and a blur of concrete, Tally hurling her cycle around a low-grav velodrome. Fast forward. A dining scene, tension of velvet straps across her shoulders, the young man across the table leaning forward to pour more wine. Fast forward. Linen sheets, a hand between her legs, purple twilight through plate glass, sound of running water. Reverse, the restaurant. The red wine gurgling into her glass. Little more. Hold it, there. Callie's eyes had been focused on the boy's tanned wrist, not on the bottle. I want a graphic of the visual, she said, pulling off the trodes. She sat up and took a swallow of beer, which mingled weirdly with the ghost flavor of Tally's recorded wine. The printer downstairs chimed softly as it completed its task. She forced herself to take the stairs slowly, but when she reached the printer in the kitchen, the image disappointed her. "Can you clear this up?" she asked the house. "I want to be able to read the label on the bottle." "Justifying image," the house said, "and rotating target object 8 degrees." The printer hummed softly as the new graphic was extruded. Angie found her treasure before the machine could chime, her dream sigil in brown ink, T-A. They'd had their own vineyards, she thought. Tessier Ashpool, S.A., the typeface regal and spidery. "Gotcha," she whispered. 8. Texas Radio. Mona could see the sun through a couple of rips in the black plastic they kept taped over the window. She hated the squat too much to stay there when she was awake or straight, and now she was both. She got quietly out of bed, wincing when her bare heel brushed the floor, and fumbled for her plastic thongs. The place was dirty. You could probably get tetanus from leaning up against the wall. Made her skin crawl to think about it. Stuff like that didn't seem to bother Eddie. He was too far gone in his schemes to notice his surroundings much. And he always managed to keep clean, somehow, like a cat. He was cat clean, never a fleck of dirt under his polished nails. She figured he probably spent most of what she earned on his wardrobe, although it wouldn't have occurred to her to question the fact. She was 16 and sinless, Mona, and this older trick had told her once that that was a song, 16 and sinless. Meant she hadn't been assigned a sin, S-I-N, when she was born, a single identification number. So she'd grown up on the outside of most official systems. She knew that it was supposed to be possible to get a sin if you didn't have one, but it stood to reason you'd have to go into a building somewhere and talk to a suit, and that was a long way from Mona's idea of a good time or even normal behavior. She had a drill for getting dressed in the squat, and she could do it in the dark. You got your thongs on, after giving them a quick knock together to dislodge possible crawlies, and then you walked over to where you knew there was a roll of old facts on a styrofoam crate beside the window. You peeled off about a meter of facts, maybe a day and a half of Asahi Shimbun, folded and creased it, put it down on the floor. Then you could stand on it, get the plastic bag from beside the crate, undo the twist of wire that held it shut, and find the clothes you wanted. When you stepped out of the thongs to put your pants on, you knew you'd be stepping on fresh facts.
There was an article of faith with Mona that nothing was going to wander across the fax in the time it took her to step into a pair of jeans and get the thongs back on. You could put on a shirt or whatever, carefully reseal the bag, and get out of there. Makeup, when required, went on in the corridor outside. There was some mirror left, beside the derelict elevator, a Fuji biofluorescent strip glued above it. There was a strong piss smell beside the elevator this morning, so she decided to skip the makeup. You never saw anybody in the building, but you heard them sometimes. Music through a closed door, or footsteps just gone around a corner at the far end of a corridor. Well, that made sense. Mona had no desire to meet her neighbors either. She took the stairs down 3 flights and into the gaping dark of the underground garage. She had her flashlight in her hand, found her way with 6 quick little blinks that steered her around stagnant puddles and dangling strands of dead optic cable, up the concrete steps and out into the alley. You could smell the beach sometimes in the alley, if the wind was right, but today it just smelled of garbage. The side of the squat towered away above her, so she moved fast before some asshole decided to drop a bottle or worse. Once she was out on the avenue, she slowed, but not too much. She was conscious of the cash in her pocket and full of plans for spending it. Wouldn't do to get taken off. Not when it looked like Eddie had wrangled them some kind of ticket out. She alternated between telling herself it was a sure thing, that they were practically gone, and warning herself not to get her hopes up. She knew Eddie's sure things. Hadn't Florida been one of them? How it was warm in Florida, and the beaches were beautiful, and it was full of cute guys with money. Just the spot for a little working vacation that had already stretched into the longest month Mona could remember. Well, it was fucking hot in Florida, like a sauna. The only beaches that weren't private were polluted, dead fish rolling belly up in the shallows. Maybe the private stretches were the same, but you couldn't see them, just the chain link and the guards in shorts and cop shirts standing around. Eddie'd get excited by the weapons the guards carried and describe each one to her in numbing detail. He didn't have a gun himself, though, not as far as she knew, and Mona figured that was a good thing. Sometimes you couldn't even smell the dead fish, because there was another smell, a chlorine smell that burned the roof of your mouth, something from the factories up the coast. If there were cute guys, they were still tricks, and the ones down here weren't exactly offering to pay double. About the only thing to like about Florida was drugs, which were easy to come by and cheap and mostly industrial strength. Sometimes she imagined the bleach smell was the smell of 1,000,000 dope labs cooking some unthinkable cocktail. All those molecules thrashing their kinky little tails, hot for destiny in the street. She turned off the avenue and walked down a line of unlicensed food stalls. Her stomach started growling at the smell, but she didn't trust street food, not if she didn't have to, and there were licensed places in the mall that would take cash. Somebody was playing a trumpet in the asphalt square that had been the parking lot, a rambling Cuban solo that bounced and distorted off the concrete walls, dying notes lost in the morning clatter of the market. A soapbox evangelist spread his arms high, a pale fuzzy Jesus copying the gesture in the air above him. The projection rig was in the box he stood on, but he wore a battered nylon pack with 2 speakers sticking over each shoulder like blank chrome heads. The evangelist frowned up at Jesus and adjusted something on the belt at his waist. Jesus strobed, turned green, and vanished. Mona laughed. The man's eyes flashed God's wrath, a muscle working in his seamed cheek. Mona turned left, between rows of fruit vendors stacking oranges and grapefruit in pyramids on their battered metal carts. She entered a low, cavernous building that housed aisles of more permanent businesses. Sellers of fish and packaged foods, cheap household goods, counters serving 12 kinds of hot food. It was cooler here in the shade, and a little quieter. She found a wonton place with 6 empty stools and took one. The Chinese cook spoke to her in Spanish. She ordered by pointing. He brought her soup in a plastic bowl. She paid him with the smallest of her bills, and he made change with 8 greasy cardboard tokens. If Eddie meant it about leaving, she wouldn't be able to use them. If they stayed in Florida, she could always get some wonton. She shook her head. Gotta go. Gotta. She shoved the worn yellow discs back across the painted plyboard counter.
You keep them.
The cook swept them out of sight, bland and expressionless, a blue plastic toothpick fixed at the corner of his mouth. She took chopsticks from the glass on the counter and fished a folded noodle from the bowl. There was a suit watching her from the aisle behind the cook's pots and burners, a suit who was trying to look like something else, white sports shirt and sunglasses. More the way they stand than anything, she thought. But he had the teeth, too, and the haircut, except he had a beard. He was pretending to look around, like he was shopping, hands in his pockets, his mouth set in what he might have thought was an absent smile. He was pretty, the suit, what you could see of him behind the beard and the glasses. The smile wasn't pretty, though. It was kind of rectangular, so you could see most of his teeth. She shifted a little on the stool, uneasy. Cooking was legal, but only if you did it right, got the tax chip and everything. She was suddenly aware of the cash in her pocket. She pretended to study the laminated food handling license taped to the counter. When she looked up again, he was gone. She spent 50 on the clothes. She worked her way through 18 racks in 4 shops, everything the mall had, before she made up her mind. The vendors didn't like her trying on so many things, but it was the most she'd ever had to spend. It was noon before she'd finished, and the Florida sun was cooking the pavement as she crossed the parking lot with her 2 plastic bags. The bags, like the clothes, were second-hand. One was printed with the logo of a Ginza shoe store. The other advertised Argentinian seafood briquettes molded from reconstituted krill. She was mentally mixing and matching the things she'd bought, figuring out different outfits. From the other side of the square, the evangelist opened up at full volume, in mid-rant, like he'd warmed up to a spit-spraying fury before he'd cut the Ampian, the hologram Jesus shaking its white-robed arms and gesturing angrily to the sky, the mall, the sky again. "Rapture," he said. "Rapture's coming." Mona turned a corner at random, automatic reflex avoiding a crazy, and found herself walking past sun-faded card tables spread with cheap Indo SimStim sets, used cassettes, colored spikes of Microsoft stuck in blocks of pale blue styrofoam. There was a picture of Angie Mitchell taped up behind one of the tables, a poster Mona hadn't seen before. She stopped and studied it hungrily, taking in the star's clothes and makeup first, then trying to figure out the background, where it had been shot. Unconsciously, she adjusted her expression to approximate Angie's in the poster. Not a grin, exactly. A sort of half-grin, maybe a little sad. Mona felt a special way about Angie, because, and Trix said it sometimes, she looked like her, like she was Angie's sister. Except her nose, Mona's, had more of a tilt, and she, Angie, didn't have that smear of freckles out to her cheekbones. Mona's Angie half-grin widened as she stared, washed in the beauty of the poster, the luxury of the pictured room. She guessed it was a kind of castle. Probably it was where Angie lived. Sure, with lots of people to take care of her, do her hair and hang up her clothes, because you could see the walls were made of big rocks, and those mirrors had frames on them that were solid gold, carved with leaves and angels. The writing across the bottom would say where it was, maybe, but Mona couldn't read. Anyway, there weren't any fucking roaches there, she was sure of that, and no Eddie either. She looked down at the stim sets and briefly considered using the rest of her money. But then she wouldn't have enough for a stim. And anyway, these were old, some of them older than she was. There was Watsit, that Tally. She'd been big when Mona was maybe 9. When she got back, Eddie was waiting for her, with the tape off the window and the flies buzzing. Eddie was sprawled out on the bed, smoking a cigarette, and the suit with the beard, who'd been watching her, was sitting in the broken chair, still wearing his sunglasses. Pryor, he said that was his name, like he didn't have a first one, or like Eddie didn't have a last one. Well, she didn't have a last name herself, unless you counted Lisa, and that was more like having 2 first ones. She couldn't get much sense of him in the squat. She thought maybe that was because he was English. He wasn't really a suit, though, not like she'd thought when she'd seen him in the mall. He was onto some game, it just wasn't clear which one. He kept his eyes on her a lot, watched her pack her things in the blue Lufthansa bag he'd brought, but she couldn't feel any heat there, not like he wanted her. He just watched her, watched Eddie smoke, tapped his sunglasses on his knee, listened to Eddie's line of bullshit, and said as little as he needed to. When he did say something, it was usually funny, but the way he talked made it hard to tell when he was joking. Packing, she felt lightheaded, like she'd done a jumper, but it hadn't quite come on. The flies were fucking against the window, bumping on the dust-streaked glass, but she didn't care. Gone. She was already gone. Zipping up the bag. It was raining when they got to the airport. Florida rain, pissing down warm out of a nowhere sky. She'd never been to an airport before, but she knew them from the stims. Pryor's car was a white Datsun rental that drove itself and played elevator music through quad speakers. It left them beside their luggage in a bare concrete bay and drove away in the rain. If Pryor had a bag, it wasn't with him. Mona had her Lufthansa bag, and Eddie had two black Gator clone suitcases. She tugged her new skirt down over her hips and wondered if she'd bought the right shoes. Eddie was enjoying himself, had his hands in his pockets and his shoulders tilted to show he was doing something important. She remembered him in Cleveland the first time, how he'd come out to the place to look at a scoot the old man had for sale, a three-wheel Skoda that was mostly rust. The old man grew catfish in concrete tanks that fenced the dirt yard. She was in the house when Eddie came, long, high-walled space of a truck trailer up on blocks. There were windows cut down one side, square holes sealed over with scratched plastic. She was standing by the stove, smell of onions in sacks and tomatoes hung up to dry, when she felt him there, down the length of the room, sensed the muscle and shoulder of him, his white teeth, the black nylon cap held shyly in his hand. Sun was coming in the windows, the place lit up, bare and plain, the floor swept the way the old man had her keep it, but it was like a shadow came. Blood shadow where she heard the pumping of her heart, and him coming closer, tossing the cap on the bare chipboard table as he passed it. Not shy now, but like he lived there, right up to her, running a hand with a bright ring back through the oiled weight of his hair. The old man came in then, and Mona turned away, pretended to do something with the stove. "Coffee," the old man said, and Mona went to get some water, filling the enamel pot from the roof tank line, the water gurgling down through the charcoal filter. Eddie and the old man sitting at the table, drinking black coffee. Eddie's legs spread straight out under the table, thighs hard through threadbare denim. Smiling, jiving the old man, dealing for the Skoda. How it seemed to run okay, how he'd buy it if the old man had the title. Old man getting up to dig in a drawer. Eddie's eyes on her again. She followed them out into the yard and watched him straddle the cracked vinyl saddle. Backfire set the old man's black dogs yelping, high sweet smell of cheap alcohol exhaust, and the frame trembling between his legs. Now she watched him pose beside his suitcases, and it was hard to connect that up, why she'd left with him next day on the Skoda, headed into Cleveland. The Skoda had a busted little radio you couldn't hear over the engine, just play it soft at night in a field by the road. Tuner part was cracked, so it only picked up one station. Ghost music up from some lonesome tower in Texas. Steel guitar fading in and out all night, feeling how she was wet against his leg and the stiff dry grass prickling the back of her neck. Pryor put her blue bag into a white cart with a striped top, and she climbed in after it, hearing tiny Spanish voices from the Cuban driver's headset. Then Eddie stowed the Gator cases, and he and Pryor got in, rolling out to the runway through walls of rain. The plane wasn't what she knew from the stims, not like a long, rich bus inside with lots of seats. It was a little black thing with sharp, skinny wings and windows that made it look like it was squinting. She went up some metal stairs, and there was a space with four seats and the same gray carpet all over, on the walls and ceiling, too, everything clean and cool and gray. Eddie came in after her and took a seat like it was something he did every day, loosening his tie and stretching his legs. Pryor was pushing buttons beside the door. It made a sighing sound when it closed. She looked out the narrow, streaming windows at runway lights reflected on wet concrete. "Came down here on the train," she thought. "New York to Atlanta. And then you change." The plane shivered. She heard the airframe creak as it came to life. She woke briefly, 2 hours later, in the darkened cabin, cradled by the long hum of the jet. Eddie was asleep, his mouth half open. Maybe Pryor was sleeping, too, or maybe he just had his eyes closed. She couldn't tell. Halfway back into a dream she wouldn't remember in the morning, she heard the sound of that Texas radio, fading steel cords drawn out like an ache. 9. Underground. Jubilee and Baker Lou, Circle and District. Kumiko peered at the little laminated map Petal had given her and shivered. The concrete platform seemed to radiate cold through the soles of her boots. "It's so fucking old," Sally Shears said absently, her glasses reflecting a convex wall sheathed in white ceramic tile.
"I beg your pardon?"
"The tube." A new tartan scarf was knotted under Sally's chin, and her breath was white when she spoke. "You know what bothers me? It's how sometimes you'll see 'em sticking new tile up in these stations, but they don't take down the old tile first. Or they'll punch a hole in the wall to get to some wiring, and you can see all these different layers of tile."
"Yes?"
"Because it's getting narrower, right? It's like arterial plaque."
"Yes,"
Kumiko said dubiously.
"I see.
Those boys, Sally, what is the meaning of their costume, please?" "Jacks. What they call Jack Draculas." The four Jack Draculas huddled like ravens on the opposite platform. They wore nondescript black raincoats and polished black combat boots laced to the knee. One turned to address another, and Kumiko saw that his hair was drawn back into a plaited queue and bound with a small black bow. "Hung him," Sally said. "After the war."
"Who?"
"Jack Dracula. They had public hangings for a while after the war. Jacks, you want to stay away from 'em. Hate anybody foreign." Kumiko would have liked to access Colin, but the Mas Neotech unit was tucked behind a marble bust in the room where Petal served their meals. And then the train arrived, amazing her with the archaic thunder of wheels on steel rails. Sally Shears against the patchwork backdrop of the city's architecture, her glasses reflecting the London jumble, each period culled by economics, by fire, by war. Kumiko, already confused by 3 rapid and apparently random train changes, let herself be hauled through a sequence of taxi rides. They'd jump out of one cab, march into the nearest large store, then take the first available exit to another street and another cab. "Harrods," Sally said at one point, as they cut briskly through an ornate, tile-walled hall pillared in marble. Kumiko blinked at thick red roasts and shanks displayed on tiered marble counters, assuming they were made of plastic. And then out again, Sally hailing the next cab. "Covent Garden," she said to the driver.
"Excuse me, Sally, what are we doing?"
"Getting lost." Sally drank hot brandy in a tiny cafe beneath the snow-streaked glass roof of the piazza. Kumiko drank chocolate.
"Are we lost, Sally?"
"Yeah. Hope so, anyway." She looked older today, Kumiko thought, lines of tension or fatigue around her mouth.
"Sally, what is it that you do? Your friend asked if you were still retired."
"I'm a businesswoman."
"And my father is a businessman?"
"Your father is a businessman, honey." "No, not like that. I'm an indie. I make investments, mostly."
"In what do you invest?"
"In other indies." She shrugged. "Feeling curious today?" She sipped her brandy.
"You advised me to be my own spy."
"Good advice. Takes a light touch, though."
Do you live here, Sally, in London?
I travel.
Is Swain another indie?
He thinks so. He's into influence, nods in the right direction. You need that here to do business, but it gets on my nerves. She tossed back the rest of the brandy and licked her lips. Kumiko shivered. You don't have to be scared of Swain. Yanaka could have him for breakfast.
No, I thought of those boys in the subway. So thin.
The Draculas.
A gang?
Bosozoku, Sally said with fair pronunciation.
Running tribes?
Anyway, like a tribe. It wasn't the right word, but Kumiko thought she saw the distinction. They're thin because they're poor. She gestured to the waiter for a second brandy.
Sally, Kumiko said, when we came here, the route we took, the trains and cabs, that was in order to make certain we were not followed?
Nothing's ever certain.
But when we went to meet Tick, you took no precautions. We could easily have been followed. You enlist Tick to spy on Swain, yet you take no precautions. You bring me here, you take many precautions. Why?
The waiter put a steaming glass down in front of her. You're a sharp little honey, aren't you? She leaned forward and inhaled the fumes of brandy. It's like this, okay? With Tick, maybe I'm just trying to shake some action.
But Tick is concerned that Swain not discover him.
Swain won't touch him, not if he knows he's working for me.
Why?
Because he knows I might kill him. She raised the glass, looking suddenly happier.
Kill Swain?
That's right. She drank.
Then why were you so cautious today?
Because sometimes it feels good to shake it all off, get out from under. Chances are we haven't, but maybe we have. Maybe nobody, nobody at all, knows where we are. Nice feeling, huh? You could be kinked, you ever think of that? Maybe your dad, the Yak warlord, he's got a little bug planted in you so he can keep track of his daughter. You got those pretty little teeth. Maybe daddy's dentist tucked a little hardware in there one time when you were into a stim. You go to the dentist?
Yes.
You stim while he works?
Yes.
There you go. Maybe he's listening to us right now. Kumiko nearly overturned what was left of her chocolate.
Hey!
The polished nails tapped Kumiko's wrist. Don't worry about it. He wouldn't have sent you here like that with a bug. Make you too easy for his enemies to track. But you see what I mean. It's good to get out from under, or anyway, try. On our own, right?
Yes,
Kumiko said, her heart still pounding, the panic continuing to rise.
He killed my mother, she blurted,
then vomited chocolate on the cafe's gray marble floor. Sally leading her past the columns of St. Paul's, walking, not talking. Kumiko, in a disjointed trance of shame, registering random information. The white shearing that lined Sally's leather coat, the oily rainbow sheen of a pigeon's feathers as it waddled out of their way, red buses like a giant's toys in the transport museum, Sally warming her hands around a foam cup of steaming tea. Cold. It would always be cold now. The freezing damp in the city's ancient bones, the cold waters of Sumida that had filled her mother's lungs, the chill flight of the neon cranes. Her mother was fine-boned and dark, the thick spill of her hair grained with gold highlights, like some rare tropical hardwood. Her mother smelled of perfume and warm skin. Her mother told her stories about elves and fairies and Copenhagen, which was a city far away. When Kumiko dreamed of the elves, they were like her father's secretaries, lithe and staid, with black suits and furled umbrellas. The elves did many curious things in her mother's stories, and the stories were magic because they changed with the telling, and you could never be certain how a tale might end on a given night. There were princesses in the stories as well, and ballerinas, and each of them, Kumiko had known, was in some way her mother. The princess ballerinas were beautiful but poor, dancing for love in the far city's heart, where they were courted by artists and student poets, handsome and penniless. In order to support an aged parent or purchase an organ for an ailing brother, a princess ballerina was sometimes obliged to voyage very far indeed, perhaps as far as Tokyo, to dance for money. Dancing for money, the tales implied, was not a happy thing. Sally took her to a Robata bar in Earl's Court and forced her to drink a glass of sake. A smoked fugu fin floated in the hot wine, turning it the color of whiskey. They ate Robata from the smoky grill, and Kumiko felt the cold recede, but not the numbness. The decor of the bar induced a profound sense of cultural dislocation. It managed to simultaneously reflect traditional Japanese design and look as though it had been drawn up by Charles Rennie Mackintosh. She was very strange, Sally Shears, stranger than all of Gaijin London. Now she told Kumiko stories, stories about people who lived in a Japan Kumiko had never known, stories that defined her father's role in the world. The Oyabun, she called Kumiko's father. The world Sally's stories described seemed no more real than the world of her mother's fairy tales, but Kumiko began to understand the basis and extent of her father's power. Kuromaku, Sally said. The word meant black curtain. It's from Kabuki, but it means a fixer, someone who sells favors. Means behind the scenes, right? That's your father. That's Swain, too, but Swain's your old man's kobun. Or anyway, one of them. Oyabun Kobun, parent-child. That's partly where Roger gets his juice. That's why you're here now, because Roger owes it to the Oyabun. Giri, understand? He is a man of rank. Sally shook her head. Your old man, Kumi, he's it. If he's had to ship you out of town to keep you safe, means there's some serious changes on the way. "Been down the drinker?" Petal asked, as they entered the room, his eyeglass edges winking Tiffany light from a bronze and stained glass tree that grew on the sideboard. Kumiko wanted to look at the marble head that hid the Mas Neotech unit, but forced herself to look out into the garden. The snow there had become the color of London sky. "Where's Swain?" Sally asked. "Governor's out," Petal told her. Sally went to the sideboard and poured herself a glass of scotch from a heavy decanter. Kumiko saw Petal wince as the decanter came down hard on the polished wood. Any messages? No. Expect him back tonight? Can't say, really. Do you want dinner? No. I'd like a sandwich, Kumiko said. 15 minutes later, with the untouched sandwich on the black marble bedside table, she sat in the middle of the huge bed, the Mas Neotech unit between her bare feet. She left Sally drinking Swain's whiskey and staring out into the gray garden. Now she took up the unit, and Colin shuddered into focus at the foot of the bed. "Nobody can hear my half of this," he said quickly, putting a finger to his lips. "And a good thing, too. Room's bugged." Kumiko started to reply, then nodded. "Good," he said. "Smart girl. Got two conversations for you. One's your host and his minder, other's your host and Sally. Got the former about 15 minutes after you stashed me downstairs. Listen." Kumiko closed her eyes and heard the tinkle of ice in a whiskey glass. "Where's our little Jap, then?" Swain asked. "Tucked up for the night," Petal said. "Talks to herself, that one. One-sided conversation. Queer." "What about?" "Bloody little, actually. Some people do, you know." "What?" "Talk to themselves. Like to hear her?" "Christ, no. Where's the delightful Miss Shears?" "Out for her constitutional." "Call Bernie round next time. See what she's about on these little walks." "Bernie?" And Petal laughed. "He'd come back in a fucking box." Now Swain laughed. Mightn't be a bad thing either way. Bernard off our hands, and the famous Razor Girl's first slaked. Here, pour us another. None for me. Off to bed, unless you need me. No, Swain said. So, said Colin, as Kumiko opened her eyes to find him still seated on the bed. There's a voice-activated bug here in your room. The minder reviewed the recording and heard you address me. Our second segment now is more interesting. Your host sits there with his second whiskey. In comes our Sally.
Hello, she heard Swain say.
Been out taking the air?
Fuck off.
You know, Swain said, none of this was my idea. You might try keeping that in mind. You know they've got me by the balls as well.
You know, Roger, sometimes I'm tempted to believe you.
Try it. It would make things easier.
Other times I'm tempted to slit your fucking throat.
Your problem, dear, is that you never learned to delegate. You still want to do everything personally. Listen, asshole, I know where you're from, and I know how you got here, and I don't care how far you've got your tongue up Kanaka's crack or anybody else's. Sarakin.
Kumiko had never heard the word before.
I heard from them again, Swain said, his tone even, conversational. She's still on the coast, but it looks as though she'll make a move soon. East, most likely. Back on your old manor. I think that's our best bet, really. The house is impossible. Enough private security along that stretch to stop a fair-sized army.
You still trying to tell me this is just a snatch, Roger? Trying to tell me they're going to hold her for ransom?
No. Nothing's been said about selling her back.
So why don't they just hire that army? No reason they'd have to stop at fair-sized, is there? Get the mercs, right? The corporate extraction boys. She's not that hard a target. No more than some hot shit research man. Get the fucking pros in.
For perhaps the 100th time, that isn't what they want. They want you.
Roger, what do they have on you, huh? I mean, do you really not know what it is they got on me?
No, I don't. But based on what they've got on me, I'll hazard a guess.
Yeah?
Everything.
No reply.
There's another angle, he said, that came up today. They want it to look as though she's been taken out.
What?
They want it to look as though we've killed her.
And how are we supposed to manage that?
They'll provide a body. I assume, Colin said, that she left the room without comment. It ends there. 10. The Shape. He spent an hour checking the saw's bearings, then lubed them again. It was already too cold to work. He'd have to go ahead and heat the room where he kept the others, the investigators and the corpse grinder and the witch. That in itself would be enough to disturb the balance of his arrangement with Gentry, but it faded beside the problem of explaining his agreement with Kid Africa and the fact of two strangers in factory. There was no way to argue with Gentry. The juice was his, because he was the one who fiddled it out of the fission authority. Without Gentry's monthly passes on the console, the ritual moves that kept the authority convinced factory was somewhere else, someplace that paid its bill, there wouldn't be any electricity. And Gentry was so strange anyway, he thought, feeling his knees creak as he stood up and took the judge's control unit from his jacket pocket. Gentry was convinced that cyberspace had a shape, an overall total form. Not that that was the weirdest idea Slick had ever run across, but Gentry had this obsessive conviction that the shape mattered totally. The apprehension of the shape was Gentry's grail. Slick had once stimmed a net knowledge sequence about what shape the universe was. Slick figured the universe was everything there was, so how could it have a shape? If it had a shape, then there was something around it for it to have a shape in, wasn't there? And if that something was something, then wasn't that part of the universe too? This was exactly the kind of thing you didn't want to get into with Gentry, because Gentry could tie your head in knots. But Slick didn't think cyberspace was anything like the universe anyway. It was just a way of representing data. The Fission Authority had always looked like a big red Aztec pyramid, but it didn't have to. If the FA wanted it to, They could have it look like anything. Big companies had copyrights on how their stuff looked. So how could you figure the whole matrix had a particular shape? And why should it mean anything if it did? He touched the unit's power stud. The judge, 10 meters away, hummed and trembled. Slick Henry hated the judge. That was what the art people never understood. That didn't mean it didn't give him pleasure to have built the thing, to have gotten the judge out where he could see him and keep track of him and finally sort of be free of the idea of him. But that sure wasn't the same as liking him. Nearly 4 meters tall, half as broad at the shoulders, headless, the judge stood trembling in his patchwork carapace, the color of rust gone a certain way, like the handles of an old wheelbarrow, polished by the friction of 1,000 hands. He'd found a way to get that surface with chemicals and abrasives, and he'd used it on most of the judge, the old parts anyway, the scavenged parts, not the cold teeth of the circular blades or the mirrored surfaces of the joints, but the rest of the judge was that color, that finish, like a very old tool, still in hard daily use. He thumbed the joystick, and the judge took one step forward, then another. The gyros were working perfectly. Even with an arm off, the thing moved with a terrible dignity, planting its huge feet just so. Slick grinned in factory's gloom as the judge clomped toward him. 1, 2, 1, 2. He could remember every step of the judge's construction, if he wanted to, and sometimes he did, just for the comfort of being able to. He couldn't remember when he hadn't been able to remember, but sometimes he almost could. That was why he had built the judge, because he'd done something. It hadn't been anything much, but he'd been caught doing it, twice, and been judged for it, and sentenced. And then the sentence was carried out, and he hadn't been able to remember. Not anything, not for more than 5 minutes at a stretch. Stealing cars. Stealing rich people's cars. They made sure you remembered what you did. Working the joystick, he got the judge turned around and walked him into the next room, along an aisle between rows of damp-stained concrete pads that had once supported lathes and spot welders. High overhead, up in the gloom and dusty beams, dangled dead fluorescent fixtures where birds sometimes nested. Korsakovs, they called that. Something they did to your neurons so that short-term memories wouldn't stick. So that the time you did was time you lost. But he'd heard they didn't do it anymore, or anyway, not for Grand Theft Auto. People who hadn't been there thought it sounded easy, like jail, but then it's all erased. But it wasn't like that. When he'd gotten out, when it was over, 3 years strung out in a long, vague, flickering chain of fear and confusion, measured off in 5-minute intervals. And it wasn't the intervals you could remember so much as the transitions. When it was over, he'd needed to build the witch, the corpse grinder, then the investigators, and finally, now, the judge. As he guided the judge up the concrete ramp to the room where the others waited, he heard Gentry gunning his motor out on Dog Solitude. People made Gentry uncomfortable, Slick thought as he headed for the stairs, but it worked both ways. Strangers could feel the shape burning behind Gentry's eyes. His fixation came across in everything he did. Slick had no idea how he got along on his trips to the sprawl. Maybe he just dealt with people who were as intense as he was, loners on the jagged fringes of the drug and software markets. He didn't seem to care about sex at all, to the extent that Slick had no idea what it was he'd have wanted if he'd decided to care. Sex was the solitude's main drawback, as far as Slick was concerned, particularly in the winter. Summers, sometimes, he could find a girl in one of those rusty little towns. That was what had taken him to Atlantic City that time and gotten him in the kid's debt. Lately, he told himself the best solution was just to concentrate on his work, but climbing the shuddering steel stairs to the catwalk that led to Gentry's space, he found himself wondering what Cherry Chesterfield looked like under all those jackets. He thought about her hands, how they were clean and quick, but that made him see the unconscious face of the man on the stretcher, the tube feeding stuff into his left nostril, Cherry dabbing at his sunken cheeks with a tissue. Made him wince.
"Hey, Gentry,"
he bellowed out into the iron void of factory. "Coming up." Three things about Gentry weren't sharp and thin and tight. His eyes, his lips, his hair. His eyes were large and pale, gray or blue depending on the light. His lips were full and mobile. His hair was swept back into a ragged blonde rooster tail that quivered when he walked. His thinness wasn't bird's emaciation, born of a stringtown diet and bad nerves. Gentry was just narrow, the muscle packed in close, no fat at all. He dressed sharp and tight, too, black leather trimmed with jet-black beads, a style Slick remembered from his days in the Deacon Blues. The beads, as much as anything, made Slick think he was about 30. Slick was about 30 himself. Gentry stared as Slick stepped through the door into the glare of 10 100-watt bulbs, making sure Slick knew he was another obstacle coming between Gentry and the shape. He was putting a pair of motorcycle panniers up on his long steel table. They looked heavy. Slick had cut roof panels away, installed struts where needed, covered the holes with sheets of rigid plastic, caulked the resulting skylights with silicone. Then Gentry came in with a mask and a sprayer and 20 gallons of white latex paint. He didn't dust or clean anything, just lay down a thick coat over all the crud and desiccated pigeon shit, sort of glued it all down and painted over it again until it was more or less white. He painted everything but the skylights, then Slick started winching gear up from factory's floor, a small truckload of computers, cyberspace decks, a huge old hollow projection table that nearly broke the winch, effect generators, dozens of corrugated plastic cartons stuffed with the thousands of fiche Gentry had accumulated in his quest for the shape. Hundreds of meters of optics on bright new plastic reels that spoke to Slick of industrial theft. And books, old books with covers made of cloth glued over cardboard. Slick hadn't ever known how heavy books were. They had a sad smell, old books. "You're pulling a few more amps since I left," Gentry said, opening the first of the two panniers. "In your room. Got a new heater?" He began to root quickly through the contents, as though he were looking for something he needed but had misplaced. He wasn't, though, Slick knew. It was having to have someone, even someone he knew, unexpectedly in his space. "Yeah. I gotta heat the storage area again, too. Too cold to work otherwise." "No," Gentry said, looking up suddenly. "That's not a heater in your room. The amperage is wrong." "Yeah." Slick grinned, on the theory that grinning made Gentry think he was stupid and easily cowed. "Yeah, what, Slick Henry?" "It's not a heater." Gentry closed the pannier with a snap. "You can tell me what it is, or I can cut your power." "You know, Gentry, I wasn't around here, you'd have a lot less time for things." Slick raised his eyebrows meaningfully in the direction of the big projection table. "Fact is, I got two people staying with me." He saw Gentry stiffen, the pale eyes widen. "But you won't see either of them, won't hear them, nothing." "No," Gentry said, his voice tight, as he rounded the end of the table. "Because you're going to get them out of here, aren't you?" 2 weeks max, Gentry. Out. Now!" Gentry's face was inches away, and Slick smelled the sour breath of exhaustion. "Or you go with them." Slick outweighed Gentry by 10 kilos, most of it muscle, but that had never intimidated Gentry. Gentry didn't seem to know or care that he could be hurt. That was intimidating in its own way. Gentry had slapped him once, hard in the face, and Slick had looked down at the huge chrome molly wrench in his own hand, and had felt an obscure embarrassment. Gentry was holding himself rigid, starting to tremble. Slick had a pretty good idea that Gentry didn't sleep when he went to Boston or New York. He didn't always sleep that much in factory, either. Came back strung, and the first day was always the worst. "Look," Slick said, the way somebody might to a child on the verge of tears, and pulled the bag from his pocket, the bribe from Kid Africa. He held up the clear plastic Ziploc for Gentry to see. blue derms, pink tablets, a nasty-looking turd of opium and a twist of red cellophane, crystals of whiz like fat yellow throat lozenges, plastic inhalers with the Japanese manufacturer's name scraped off with a knife. "From Africa," Slick said, dangling the Ziploc. "Africa." Gentry looked at the bag, at Slick, the bag again. "From Africa?" "Kid Africa. You don't know him. Left this for you."
"Why?"
"Because he needs me to put up these friends of his for a little while. I owe him a favor, Gentry. Told him how you didn't like anybody around, how it gets in your way. So," Slick lied, "he said he wanted to leave you some stuff to make up for the trouble."
Gentry took the bag and slid his finger along the seal, opening it. He took out the opium and handed that back to Slick.
"Won't need that."
Took out one of the blue derms, peeled off the backing, and smoothed it carefully into place on the inside of his right wrist. Slick stood there, absently kneading the opium between his thumb and forefinger, making the cellophane crackle, while Gentry walked back around the long table and opened the pannier. He pulled out a new pair of black leather gloves.
"I think I'd better meet these guests of yours, Slick."
"Huh?"
Slick blinked, astonished.
"Yeah, but you don't really have to. I mean, wouldn't it be..."
"No," Gentry said, flicking up his collar.
"I insist."
Going down the stairs, Slick remembered the opium and flung it over the rail, into the dark. He hated drugs.
"Cherry?"
He felt stupid, with Gentry watching him bang his knuckles on his own door. No answer. He opened it. Dim light. He saw how she'd made a shade for one of his bulbs, a cone of yellow fax fastened with a twist of wire. She'd unscrewed the other two. She wasn't there. The stretcher was there, its occupant bundled in the blue nylon bag.
"Eating him," Slick thought, as he looked at the superstructure of support gear, the tubes, the sacks of fluid.
"No," he told himself. "It's keeping him alive, like in a hospital." But the impression lingered. What if it were draining him dry? He remembered Bird's vampire talk.
"Well," said Gentry, stepping past him to stand at the foot of the stretcher.
"Strange company you keep, Slick Henry." Gentry walked around the stretcher, keeping a cautious meter between his ankles and the still figure.
"Gentry, you sure you maybe don't want to go back up? I think that derm... maybe you did too much."
"Really?" Gentry cocked his head, his eyes glittering in the yellow glow. He winked. "Why do you think that?"
"Well..."
Slick hesitated.
"You aren't like you usually are. I mean, like you were before."
"You think I'm experiencing a mood swing, Slick?"
"Yeah."
"I'm enjoying a mood swing."
"I don't see you smiling," Cherry said from the door. "This is Gentry, Cherry. Factory's sort of his place. Cherry's from Cleveland."
But Gentry had a thin black flashlight in his gloved hand. He was examining the trode net that covered the sleeper's forehead. He straightened up, the beam finding the featureless unmarked unit, then darting down again to follow the black cable to the trode net. "Cleveland," Gentry said at last, as though it were a name he'd heard in a dream. "Interesting." He raised his light again, craning forward to peer at the point where the cable joined the unit. "And Cherry?"
"Cherry, who is he?"
The beam falling hard on the wasted, irritatingly ordinary face.
"Don't know," Cherry said. "Get that out of his eyes. Might screw up his REM or something."
"And this?" He lit the flat gray package.
"The LF," Kid called it. "Called him the Count. Called that his LF.
She thrust her hand inside her jackets and scratched herself. "Well, then," Gentry said, turning. Click as the beam died, the light of his obsession burning bright, bright behind his eyes, amplified so powerfully by Kid Africa's derm that it seemed to Slick that the shape must be right there, blazing through Gentry's forehead, for anyone at all to see except Gentry himself. That must be just what it is. 11. Down on the drag. Mona woke as they were landing. Pryor was listening to Eddie and nodding and flashing his rectangular smile. It was like the smile was always there behind his beard. He'd changed his clothes, though, so he must have had some on the plane. Now he wore a plain gray business suit and a tie with diagonal stripes. Sort of like the tricks Eddie'd set her up with in Cleveland, except the suit fit a different way. She'd seen a trick fitted for a suit once, a guy who took her to a Holiday Inn. The suit place was off the hotel lobby, and he stood in there in his underwear, cross-hatched with lines of blue light, and watched himself on three big screens. On the screens, you couldn't see the blue lines because he was wearing a different suit in each image. And Mona had to bite her tongue to keep from laughing, because the system had a cosmetic program that made him look different on the screens. Stretched his face a little and made his chin stronger, and he didn't seem to notice. Then he picked a suit, got back into the one he'd been wearing, and that was it. Eddie was explaining something to Pryor, some crucial point in the architecture of one of his scams. She knew how to tune the content out, but the tone still got to her. Like he knew people wouldn't be able to grasp the gimmick he was so proud of, so he was taking it slow and easy, like he was talking to a little kid, and he'd keep his voice low to sound patient. It didn't seem to bother Pryor, but then it seemed to Mona that Pryor didn't much give a shit what Eddie said. She yawned, stretched, and the plane bumped twice on runway concrete, roared, began to slow. Eddie hadn't even stopped talking. "We have a car waiting," Pryor said, interrupting him. "So where's it taking us?" Mona asked, ignoring Eddie's frown. Pryor showed her the smile. "To our hotel." He unfastened his seatbelt. "We'll be there for a few days. Afraid you'll have to spend most of them in your room." "That's the deal," Eddie said, like it was his idea she'd have to stay in the room. "You like stims, Mona?" Pryor asked, still smiling. "Sure," she said. "Who doesn't?" "Have a favorite, Mona? A favorite star?" "Angie," she said, vaguely irritated. "Who else?" The smile got a little bigger. "Good. We'll get you all of her latest tapes." Mona's universe consisted in large part of things and places she knew but had never physically seen or visited. The hub of the northern sprawl didn't smell in Stims. They edited it out, she guessed, the way Angie never had a headache or a bad period. But it did smell, like Cleveland, but even worse. She'd thought it was just the way the airport smelled when they left the plane, but it had been even stronger when they'd gotten out of their car to go into the hotel. And it was cold as hell in the street, too, with a wind that bit at her bare ankles. The hotel was bigger than that Holiday Inn, but older, too, she thought. The lobby was more crowded than lobbies were in Stims, but there was a lot of clean blue carpet. Pryor made her wait by an ad for an orbital spa while he and Eddie went over to a long black counter and he talked to a woman with a brass name tag. She felt stupid waiting there, in this white plastic raincoat Pryor had made her wear, like he didn't think her outfit was good enough. About a third of the crowd in the lobby were Japs, she figured, for tourists. They all seemed to have recording gear of some kind. Video, holo, a few with SimStim units on their belts. But otherwise, they didn't look like they had a whole lot of money. She thought they were all supposed to have a lot. "Maybe they're smart, don't want to show it," she decided. She saw Pryor slide a credit chip across the counter to the woman with the name tag, who took it and zipped it along a metal slot. Pryor put her bag down on the bed, a wide slab of beige temper foam, and touched a panel that caused a wall of drapes to open. "It's not the Ritz," he said, "but we'll try to make you comfortable. Mona made a non-committal sound. The Ritz was a burger place in Cleveland, and she couldn't see what that had to do with anything. "Look," he said, "your favorite." He was standing beside the bed's upholstered headboard. There was a stim unit there, built in, and a little shelf with a set of trodes in a plastic wrapper and about 5 cassettes. All of Angie's new stims. She wondered who'd put those cassettes there, and if they'd done it after Pryor had asked her what stims she liked. She showed him a smile of her own and went to the window. The sprawl looked like it did in stims. The window was like a hologram postcard, famous buildings she didn't know the names of, but she knew they were famous. Gray of the domes, geodesics picked out white with snow. Behind that, the gray of the sky. "Happy, baby?" Eddie asked, coming up behind her and putting his hands on her shoulders. "They got showers here?" Pryor laughed. She shrugged out of Eddie's loose grip and took her bag into the bathroom, closed and locked the door. She heard Pryor's laugh again, and Eddie starting up with his scam talk. She sat on the toilet, opened her bag, and dug out the cosmetic kit where she kept her whiz. She had 4 crystals left. That seemed like enough. 3 was enough, but when she got down to 2, she usually started looking to score. She didn't do jumpers much, not every day anyway, except recently she had, but that was because Florida had started to drive her crazy. Now she could start tapering off, she decided, as she tapped a crystal out of the vial. It looked like hard yellow candy. You had to crush it, then grind it up between a pair of nylon screens. When you did that, it gave off a kind of hospital smell. They were both gone by the time she finished her shower. She'd stayed in until she got bored with it, which took a long time. In Florida, she'd mostly used showers at public pools or bus stations, the kind you worked with tokens. She guessed there was something hooked up to this one that measured the liters and put it on your bill. That was how it worked at the Holiday Inn. There was a big white filter above the plastic showerhead, and a sticker on the tile wall with an eye and a tear, and it was okay to shower, but don't get it in your eyes, like swimming pool water. There was a row of chrome spouts set into the tile, and when you punched a button under each one, you got shampoo, shower gel, liquid soap, bath oil. When you did that, a little red dot lit up beside the button, because it went on your bill. On Pryor's bill. She was glad they were gone, because she liked being alone and high and clean. She didn't get to be alone much, except on the street, and that wasn't the same. She left damp footprints on the beige carpet when she walked to the window. She was wrapped in a big towel that matched the bed and the carpet and had a word shaved into the fuzzy part, probably the name of the hotel. There was an old-fashioned building a block away, and the corners of its stepped peak had been carved down to make a kind of mountain, with rocks and grass, and a waterfall that fell and hit rocks and then fell again. It made her smile. Why anybody had gone to that trouble. Drifts of steam came off the water where it hit. It couldn't just fall down into the street, though, she thought, because it would cost too much. She guessed they pumped it back up and used it over, around in a circle. Something gray moved its head there, swung its big curly horns up, like it was looking at her. She took a step back on the carpet and blinked. Kind of a sheep, but it had to be a remote. A hologram or something. It tossed its head and started eating grass. Mona laughed. She could feel the whiz down the backs of her ankles and across her shoulder blades, a cold, tight tingle, and the hospital smell at the back of her throat. She'd been scared before, but she wasn't scared now. Pryor had a bad smile, but he was just a player, just a bent suit. If he had money, it was somebody else's. And she wasn't scared of Eddie anymore. It was almost like she was scared for him, because she could see what other people took him for. Well, she thought, it didn't matter. She wasn't growing catfish in Cleveland anymore, and no way anybody'd get her back to Florida again. She remembered the alcohol stove, cold winter mornings, the old man hunched in his big gray coat. Winters, he'd put a second layer of plastic over the windows.
The stove was enough to heat the place then, because the walls were covered with sheets of hard foam, and chipboard over that. Places where the foam showed, you could pick at it with your finger, make holes. If he caught you doing it, he'd yell. Keeping the fish warm in cold weather was more work. You had to pump water up to the roof, where the sun mirrors were, into these clear plastic tubes. But the vegetable stuff rotting on the tank ledges helped, too. Steam rose off when you went to net a fish. He traded the fish for other kinds of food, for things people grew. Stove alcohol and the drinking kind, coffee beans, garbage the fish ate. He wasn't her father, and he'd said it often enough, when he'd talked at all. Sometimes she still wondered if maybe he had been. When she'd first asked him how old she was, he'd said 6, so she counted from that. She heard the door open behind her and turned. Pryor was there, the gold plastic key tab in his hand, beard open to show the smile. "Mona," he said, stepping in. "This is Gerald." Tall, Chinese, gray suit, graying hair. Gerald smiled gently, edged in past Pryor, and went straight for the drawer thing opposite the foot of the bed. Put a black case down and clicked it open. "Gerald's a friend. He's medical, Gerald. Needs to have a look at you." "Mona," Gerald said, removing something from the case. "How old are you?" "She's 16, Pryor said. "Right, Mona?" 16, Gerald said. The thing in his hands was like a pair of black goggles, sunglasses with bumps and wires. "That's stretching it a little, isn't it?" He looked at Pryor. Pryor smiled. "You're short what, 10 years? "Not quite," Pryor said. "We aren't asking for perfection." Gerald looked at her. "You aren't going to get it." He hooked the goggles over his ears and tapped something. A light came on below the right lens. "But there are degrees of approximation." The light swung toward her. "We're talking cosmetic, Gerald." "Where's Eddie?" she asked as Gerald came closer. "In the bar. Shall I call him?" Pryor picked up the phone, but put it back down without using it. "What is this?" Backing away from Gerald. "A medical examination," Gerald said. "Nothing painful." He had her against the window, above the towel, her shoulder blades pressed against cool glass. "Someone's about to employ you, and pay you very well. They need to be certain you're in good health." The light stabbed into her left eye. "She's on stimulants of some kind," he said to Pryor, in a different tone of voice. "Try not to blink, Mona." The light swung to her right eye. "What is it, Mona? How much did you do?"
"Whiz."
Wincing away from the light, he caught her chin in his cool fingers and realigned her head. "How much?"
"A crystal."
The light was gone. His smooth face was very close, the goggles studded with lenses, slots, little dishes of black metal mesh. "No way of judging the purity," he said.
"It's real pure," she said, and giggled.
He let her chin go and smiled. "It shouldn't be a problem," he said. "Could you open your mouth, please?"
"Mouth?"
"I want to look at your teeth." She looked at Pryor. "You're in luck here," Gerald said to Pryor, when he'd used the little light to look in her mouth. "Fairly good condition and close to target configuration. Caps, inlays."
"We knew we could count on you, Gerald."
Gerald took the goggles off and looked at Pryor. He returned to the black case and put the goggles away. "Lucky with the eyes, too. Very close. A tint job." He took a foil envelope from the case and tore it open, rolled the pale surgical glove down over his right hand. "Take off the towel, Mona. Make yourself comfortable." She looked at Pryor, at Gerald.
"You want to see my papers, the blood work and stuff?"
"No," Gerald said. "That's fine." She looked out the window, hoping to see the bighorn, but it was gone, and the sky seemed a lot darker. She undid the towel, let it fall to the floor, then lay down on her back on the beige temper foam. It wasn't all that different from what she got paid for. It didn't even take as long. Sitting in the bathroom with the cosmetic kit open on her knees, grinding another crystal, she decided she had a right to be pissed off. First Eddie takes off without her, then Pryor shows up with this creep medic. Then he tells her Eddie's sleeping in a different room. Back in Florida, she could have used some time off from Eddie, but up here was different. She didn't want to be in here by herself, and she'd been scared to ask Pryor for a key. He fucking well had one, though, so he could walk in any time with his creep-ass friends. What kind of deal was that? And the business with the plastic raincoat, that burned her ass, too. A disposable fucking plastic raincoat. She fluffed the powdered whiz between the nylon screens, carefully tapped it into the hitter, exhaled hard, put the mouthpiece to her lips, and hit. The cloud of yellow dust coated the membranes of her throat. Some of it probably even made it to her lungs. She'd heard that was bad for you. She hadn't had any plan when she'd gone in the bathroom to take her hit, but as the back of her neck started tingling, she found herself thinking about the streets around the hotel, what she'd seen of them on their way in. There were clubs, bars, shops with clothes in the window. Music. Music would be okay now, and a crowd. The way you could lose it in a crowd, forget yourself, just be there. The door wasn't locked, she knew that. She'd already tried it. It would lock behind her, though, and she didn't have a key. But she was staying here, so Pryor must have registered her at the desk. She thought about going down and asking the woman behind the counter for a key, but the idea made her uncomfortable. She knew suits behind counters and how they looked at you. No, she decided, the best idea was to stay in and stim those new Angies. 10 minutes later, she was on her way out a side entrance, off the main lobby, the whiz singing in her head. It was drizzling outside, maybe dome condensation. She'd worn the white raincoat for the lobby, figuring Pryor knew what he was doing after all, but now she was glad she had it. She grabbed a fold of fax out of an overflowing bin and held it over her head to keep her hair dry. It wasn't as cold as before, which was another good thing. None of her new clothes were what you'd call warm. Looking up and down the avenue, deciding which way to go, she took in half a dozen nearly identical hotel fronts, a rank of pedicabs, the rain-slick glitter of a row of small shops, and people, lots of them, like the Cleveland Corps, but everybody dressed so sharp, and all moving like they were on top of it, everybody with some place to go. Just go with it, she thought. The whiz giving her a sweet second boot that tripped her into the river of pretty people without even having to think about it, clicking along in her new shoes, holding the fax over her head until she noticed more luck. The rain had stopped. End of Side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.